We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You're listening to Setting the Pace, your go-to Pacers podcast with Alex Golden and Michael Facci.
Sabonis down the lane with authority.
Oh, Miles Turner bringing that smoke.
Clifford skies high for the jam.
Warren lets it fly.
Yes! T.J. Warren is not human.
The Setting the Pace podcast had Kevin Pritchard on.
Well, you got it Setting the Pace, and I think that's terrific.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Setting the Pace, and I am joined today by Mark Schindler and Red Bauer to talk all things Indiana Pacers, specifically our young players that have been, you know, kind of thrust into a bigger role than they probably would have gotten had there not been so many injuries. But we're going to talk about that today. So, Mark, how you doing, man?
I'm good, Alex. I can't complain, man. It's been a minute, so it's good to catch up with you and Rhett and get on another one of these. How are things on your end?
Things are going great here. Just staying busy, trying to, you know, catch up with all the pods that are out there. It's hard to even catch up listening to them, but I do enjoy the Locker Room app whenever you go live and I'm able to catch those live.
I appreciate it, man.
Those are fun. I like hearing just people throw different conversations out there. I mean, it's always fun to go on Locker Room app, but I still got to figure my way around it. I've done it a few times and I've not been impressed with myself on it. So it's different doing a kind of a pod by yourself, but so Rhett, thanks for joining, man. How you doing?
Yeah, absolutely, Alex. Thanks for having me on. I'm doing great. Just like Mark said, glad to be back and talk about some young guys.
Yeah, for sure. So I think obviously the young guy that I want to start with here is the guy that we just recently picked up, O'Shea Brissett. And he's been playing really well for the Pacers since he did sign that three-year contract. We know the last 2 years of that contract are not guaranteed, so they don't count against the Pacers. But I don't envision them turning down any of those team options there. But I'll start first with you, Mark. What have your overall thoughts been on O'Shea Brissett in this short amount of time that we've gotten to see him?
I think he's been great, you know, especially given what he's doing in his role. It's been I don't want to say like I've been optimistically waiting for things to kind of stop clicking for him, but like it feels like things are – like it, in some regards, like too good to be true. I think we're at a point now where we can say, okay, cool. We're going to get this consistently from O'Shea. Was not a good shooter at Syracuse. Wasn't a good shooter in the G League. Was like a pretty average to mediocre free throw shooter. But I mean, he looks good taking them. He's comfortable. He's taking a lot of threes. The free throws look good too. And he's getting there almost five times a game. And it's crazy too, because even when he was at Syracuse, he didn't even block a shot per game for both of his years there, and he's averaging almost two blocks a game now. It's not all just averages and everything, but you can see the way that it plays out on court. What he brings is a lot of what, you know, like this system and just this team in general has been missing, in having somebody who can both close out and rotate as the low man. And I mean, the offense has been important too, and we can talk about that more, but just like what he's done defensively has been huge. He's been solid on the glass as well. I don't think he's like a killer on the glass or anything. But no, he's far and away outplayed any expectations I have for him.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rhett.
I could not agree more. And it's just really interesting when you see him on the court, because it doesn't seem like he does very many things wrong. Like, it just seems like he makes the right play and the right read, the right cut, the right rotation. He just seems to just know where to be on a basketball court, which is a big deal, especially with his size, with him able to just impact the game so much everywhere pretty much. And I think I'm really, really interested to see what he looks like next to Domas now that he's back. But last night's game is not the measuring stick that we're going to use as what Brissett would look like next to an actual center. So I'm hopeful we get to see more of that as Domas stays healthy, and just see what he looks like next to a center as the type of forward that we've been missing all year. And frankly, he might be a better fit for the power forward position than what Warren is. So we could get a better idea of what an actual stretch four looks like next to Domas.
Yeah, you bring up a good point there, because that was one of the questions I was going to ask in a little bit. But since you brought up TJ Warren, I'm just kind of curious, like, if the Pacers do trade one of their centers this offseason, which I think we believe they will, and let's just say they're not able to get that, you know, guy that can play the four, are you satisfied with TJ Warren and O'Shea Brissett being pretty much your only true fours on the roster? I'll start with you, Rhett.
I think it really depends on what we get back in a trade that involves in either of the bigs. Because if we have a big enough three, then I could see Warren playing the four and just like interchanging those two back and forth. But if Brissett's shooting is real, obviously not the 45% from three that he's shooting, because that would be just unheard of. But if he's around the 37, 38 mark, then yeah, I think it would be fine for him to be out there as a starter. But I would just be hard pressed to imagine us trading one of the bigs and not getting a starter level player in return.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think I was talking about this with Tony East the other day, just on the timeline. I was like, you know, I've been hesitant to say it because I don't want to get people's expectations up. I know people can get excited about things like O'Shea Brissett has played it as a starting level player. Like, obviously that sounds arbitrary. He's been a starter since he came into the lineup, but like, just in reality, like, he looks like a guy who he does the things that could make him an actual starter on a real team when it's fully healthy. But I also think that brings into question, like, how much stock do you want to put in a guy who was playing on a 10-day and just got, you know, a 3-year partially guaranteed deal? Like, I still think the front office needs to be aggressive in getting more forward size players on the roster, because that's just been such a problem this year. And I don't personally necessarily agree with this, but I did have somebody bring up to me, you know, should it upset people that, you know, the front office was able to bring in this guy 10-day, 60 games in, and have this kind of impact, and that wasn't something that was prioritized beforehand. I don't think I would say that it wasn't prioritized. Clearly, you know, they tried to go get Gordon Hayward, and that didn't work out. But it does beg the question a little bit. And I think it just points out the team needs that kind of player on the roster, and not just one. Like, there needs to be more than one. So I think I would say, even if it's just TJ and O'Shea, you got to get another forward-sized player on the roster. Ideally, somebody who's like a 4-5. Especially if one of the bigs gets traded, because you need that versatility, because the team has really lacked that all year.
That's what I was going to say, is O'Shea does not answer the question. He's more of a luxury to have because he is on that non-guaranteed deal for the next 2 years. He's not like, you don't stop looking for a forward-sized player because you have O'Shea Brissett. Like, you still should have more options at the three and the four than just O'Shea and Warren.
Yeah, and another thing I was going to add to that, with Warren's injury history, how much can you really rely on that either? You know, so it'd be nice just to have another one, and maybe there's an opportunity where you can get someone that might be an upgrade over O'Shea, but you could kind of play them as the backup three and four, depending on what they trade and what they get back. Not saying they have to get back a three or four, but let's say they traded one of the bigs for a point guard or something like that, and then slid everybody down a position, Brogdon, LeVert, and Warren down to the two, the three, and the four. You know, whoever they get maybe coming off the bench could be like that six man type of player, but I would prefer it to be, you know, a bigger wing, a bigger power forward, something like that, just because I really do believe that is the position that this team has been lacking for quite some time, especially since they got rid of Thad Young, but maybe a little bit of a better shooter than Thad, even though Thad did bring a lot of different intangibles to the table. I just think maybe someone that's a little bit more versatile on the outside and the perimeter. But moving on from O'Shea, I want to talk about the next guy, and that is Edmund Sumner. Edmund Sumner has had just a fantastic season, and I think you really can't say enough great things about him. But, Mark, I want to get your thoughts. I mean, where do you see him fitting in long-term with this Pacers team to start things off, and what have you been so impressed by Edmund Sumner this season?
Yeah, no, it's a lot of good questions. I think just with Ed, it's been the confidence and getting comfortable on court, because that's never been really anything he could do. He's never been somebody who's been able to be in the lineup consistently. There was always an injury that popped up, or somebody came back healthy and they overtook his spot in the lineup. So seeing him, like, his numbers aren't drastically different from where he was at last year. I mean, obviously the 3-point shooting is, but in terms of like finishing and everything, like, he's just, he's so much more comfortable. Like, instead of seeing him, you know, some of the things he used to throw up on the way to the rim last year were like, man, very, very erratic. But now, I mean, he's just so comfortable getting there. He's close to, I mean, other than TJ and maybe Doug McDermott, he's probably the best finisher on the team that's not a big. He's just been fantastic. The 3-point shooting has been huge for him as well. I still don't know quite what to think of him as a 3-point shooter, because he doesn't take a lot of them, but he's confident when he does take them. He doesn't just pass up a bunch of open ones. He's taking stuff off the dribble. And it's just opened up a lot for him in the drive game too. I think what I'm most impressed about that hasn't been talked about a lot is he's doing a lot as a passer out of the drive game too. That's been nice. Like, mm-hmm. his assist numbers aren't anything crazy, but you know, just in watching the games, he has some really nice passes out of it that used to be either turnovers or really heavily contested layup. So I'm interested to see if he can expand on that this offseason into next year, because that would change up what I think of him. Because right now, I don't think he's a necessarily a starting level player. I don't mean that as a dig or a slight or anything. I just think, you know, if you're looking especially at like the higher end in playoff basketball, the team's going to zero in on Ed and say, okay, shoot it. Or like, there are still ways to kind of exploit what he does. He doesn't really have an in-between game. If it's not going at the rim and his shot's not going in, it's just hard to see what he's doing offensively, which maybe is an unfair way to look at it. But I think ideally he's probably just a really, really good seventh man who's playing 20 minutes. And I think he could be the sixth man or maybe a more consistent starter if his ball handling and passing open up more. But right now, I think that's one of the things you've been seeing with him. Like, it's looked really nice offensively, but I do have questions about, you know, what can his passing get just a little bit better. But he's been awesome this year, man. And defensively too. I mean, we know what he brings. I think it's the only issue is, like, you can't really, like, the way that the backcourt is set up, it works well because he can guard ones a little bit more confidently. Like, we saw him on Steph Curry earlier in the year, and Malcolm is much better guarding up a position. But yeah, Ed's been fantastic. It's really been awesome just to see him have a healthy season and get to show his game. It's been cool.
I think the best part about it for me is, like you said, the confidence is absolutely true, but it seems like he's still going full speed, but far more under control. And that's a huge, huge thing.
The opposite of Aaron Holiday.
Oh, right, exactly. it's his finishing at the rim and all of that is
also the opposite of Aaron Holiday.
Exactly.
Sorry,
exactly.
I don't mean to dog Aaron. No, it's been hard to watch, man.
It's been rough. But Ed, he's not a starter level player, and I think that's okay. I don't think he's versatile enough offensively or enough of a lockdown defensively to have a spot in the starting lineup. Just because of what Mark was saying is, like, it's either a spot up three or attacking a closeout and getting all the way to the rim. And other than that, he's not much of a threat offensively, and defenses are probably okay with Edmund Sumner being the reason their defense gets broken down. Like, that's probably not a huge, huge priority on the defense with the other players out there on the floor. But I'm really interested to see, like, if you look at Sumner's numbers throughout the years, he was at 63% from the free throw line in 2018-19, 55% last year, all the way up to 81% this year. And it's on very low volume, but that also correlates with his 3-point percentage going from 26% up to almost 39%. I really want to see how real those numbers are. And I would like for him to shoot more than the 1.7 per game that he's been shooting so far this year, just to get a better sample size of how real that shooting is. Because if he's, I don't think he's a 39% three-point shooter, but if he can be in the 36 range, taking three or four a game or something like that, that's huge for the bench. And I just think the more confident he gets shooting the ball from outside, obviously we know what he can do getting to the rim. That's just going to open up so much more, especially if the team decides to keep TJ McConnell. You can use that spacing out there with him if we end up not bringing back Doug McDermott.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. His numbers have been quite interesting this year. I've been surprised by how well he has shot the three, just because I was never expecting that from him, because he just hadn't really been there before. Very inconsistent. That's why I wasn't sure if he was going to ever get an opportunity to, you know, last as a rotational player, just because of his inconsistency with the shot. But there was that special, I think, on Fox Sports where they talked about how he kind of changed his shooting rhythm a little bit, or shooting motion with one of the trainers. And I think that definitely has improved. And I heard Tony E say this on a radio interview. He said that every shot Goga takes, you think it's going to go in, but it misses. And every shot Ed shoots, you think it's going to miss, but it goes in. And it really couldn't be more true, just, you know, just hearing him say that, because a lot of the shots Ed takes, I'm surprised they go in, because the form just looks a little different. But I want to go back to you here, Rhett, because as we get into the offseason, I know obviously this team still has, what, like 10 games left, something like that, and there's going to be a playing game, so we know that this team is not done. But heading into the offseason, I'm not saying I want to trade Edmund Sumner, but what do you think his trade value is amongst the league?
That's a really tough question, because the questions that we just asked probably are being asked by other teams in the league. You know, is his shooting real? You know, can he do more with the ball in his hands as a passer? What can he do in the pick and roll? Or is he just an off guard that takes less than two threes a game and scores within 2 seconds of a made basket? Like, what are his limitations as an offensive player? And I think that question and that group of questions probably lends to him being more valuable to the Pacers than what any other team would want to give up for him, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Mark, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have a couple. So number one, this is just a really interesting point, because I think, and I don't mean this it's more just from an observational standpoint. It's not in a good or bad way. It's more just, you know, this is where it becomes really interesting looking at the Pacers, because, you know, you look at what TJ McConnell has done for the team this year. And I mean, the team probably wins 4 or 5 less games without him. And that might be even, you know,
selling short.
Yeah, that might be selling short. I almost said generous. You know me, I'm bad with analogies at times.
Gotcha. That's all right.
But, you know, I think if you look at this year, and maybe if they approached it more as a developmental year instead of wanting to make the playoffs still. And you say, okay, instead of, you know, bringing back TJ McConnell, we won't guarantee his offer. And we're just going to run everything with Ed and Aaron Holiday. And you definitely lose a lot more games doing that. TJ McConnell is the best player of the three for sure. And arguably has been a top 5 player on the team this year. But then you look at it, and I think maybe 30 or 40 games in, you start to see what these guys are really doing, what they're bringing at the next level. So I think, like, that's one of the things with Ed, like, we're not really, I just don't think we're ever going to know what he can do as a ball handler, because he's never going to get the opportunity to do it. And I'm not saying that as a slight to the coaching staff or to the front office. That's what they're doing. That's their direction. They want to be competitive. They want to make the play-in game right now. And I think if we were going to see Ed get the opportunity with the ball in his hands, it would have happened this year already.
Yep.
And not that he hasn't ever had opportunities, but just point being, like, if you really want to get a guy live player development reps, you're going to be giving him a lot of opportunities. So I think I would say that Ed is probably more valuable to the Pacers right now than he would be to anyone outside. I don't have like an exact answer for what he might be worth on the open market. Like, maybe, like, I mean, probably worth more than Aaron Holiday, because they're about the same age, and he's proven just at this point to have a little bit more versatility, but I still don't know if he'd be much more than like a second round pick.
And yeah. I think really if he does get traded, which I think is unlikely because of how much like the Pacers have invested in him, like it hasn't been that much, but they've had chances to let him go and they haven't done it. And now he's finally having his best season as a pro, but it would be as like on top of somebody else rather than like straight up trading Edmund Sumner for a first round pick or something like that. I don't see that happening. He'd be like the last pick instead of the Pacers trading a first or something like that. I don't have any example in my head, but that's the only way I can see it happening.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I was thinking. If he was like put into a package, how much would a team value his level of play? You know, what he brings to the table. But just to kind of wrap up the Sumner conversation, I'll start with you, Mark. I'm just curious, how much do you think he's benefited from the Bjorkren system compared to the McMillan system? Not necessarily with, I guess how does he fit into both systems differently, but is it more of a system thing why he's been playing so well, or do you think it's just because of the opportunities, because of all the injuries?
Oh, I think it's definitely opportunity. I think he would have been fine in McMillan's system if he just got to play. You know, it helps. I'm sure that the system helps because he's been such a good driver. And you know, that's what he's really predicated his game on, because he's so good at doing it, and that he gets the opportunity to do it this much. And it's the focal point of the offense really helps him. But I also just think that it's been the opportunity in general has been huge for him. And even then, like he DNP coaching decisions the first like 20 games of the year. So it's like, you know, it's different. And the one last thing I would want to say too, with like, you know, I just mentioned with him getting the reps, it's just in case people start to think, well, what about Aaron Holiday? Aaron Holiday has gotten the reps this year. He has routinely gotten the opportunity to make things work, and it just hasn't worked out, unfortunately. But again, like that's the thing. If TJ is not there, then Ed's probably getting more of that. But I just wanted to add that really quick.
Mm-hmm. Rhett, any thoughts on that?
There could be an argument made that Aaron has gotten too much opportunity with how poorly he's played. I don't think that's the case, because I think he needs to have he needs a little bit more, because we know he can play better than what he's been doing. But Aaron has definitely gotten opportunity, and I think that we talked about it before the season about TJ McConnell, and obviously he's been incredible, but there's definitely been a conscious decision by the front office to prioritize winning and playing TJ McConnell versus trying to give Sumner and Aaron as much opportunity as possible.
Yeah, and I definitely want to hit on Aaron, obviously, with this conversation, but I don't want to do it just yet. I want to save him and Goga till the end. I want to move on to our second-round pick, Cassius Stanley, who is on a two-way contract. I couldn't think of the word there for a second, but two-way contract. And I'll start with you first, Red. I mean, obviously there's not been much of a sample size here with Cassius in the NBA, but I mean, what are your thoughts on where he's projected for next season for the Pacers?
I think he's probably going to be, it depends on if the Pacers are able to consolidate any of their bench players. Cause right now I think they have like 11 actual NBA players that could play at any given time. And so Stanley just doesn't have a chance to get any sort of opportunity, unless we're in a situation where we are right now, where, you know, we just have ridiculous amount of injuries. But I don't know what Stanley is going to be good at the actual true NBA level to be able to get minutes and to get opportunity. I don't think we've seen enough of him to really know if he's anything other than an athlete at the NBA level.
Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a real avenue to Cassius being a rotation player. And you know, I mean, like, I never want to cap a guy. Like, you could, of course, see him as a starter somehow, but his handle would have to develop a ton. Like, he is a very – like, his handle would be the worst out of any of the guards on the roster right now. Or any of the wings, just for that matter. He came out, you know, super underdeveloped with that. But I mean, he's probably the most athletic player on the team too, like over Edmund Sumner for sure, which is saying a lot. I mean, his ups are crazy. He just has a lot of power in his game. I think if the shot can fall for him and be real, and then he can attack closeouts, you could see from there. But I do think like the defense was solid at Duke. Like, he has the ability to slide his feet. He's got good lateral quickness, but it's just getting a better feel for the game defensively. And I think it's tough because he did not have a great bubble. But I mean, part of it's because they clearly were prioritizing his development there. Like, they made sure that he was getting the most touches out of anyone on the team. And I think that was good for him. But at the same time, I would like to see him get like maybe a couple opportunities at the NBA level. I don't think that he's really ready for it. So it'll be very much so throwing him into the fire. But with, you know, 10 games to go, I don't think it's going to hurt anything. So, but I do think that there's a road to him being a part of the rotation, but I just, his shot has to be a lot more consistent, and there just has to be opportunity too. Cause right now there isn't, like, there's not really an avenue where you can see, unless like three or four guys get traded or leave. I don't really see how he's going to have a road to meaningful minutes next year.
Yeah. I don't see meaningful minutes coming anytime soon for him, but I was a little bit surprised a couple of weeks ago when we played the Thunder and there was like so many injuries. I feel like he was one of the only guys, him and Bowen, before he was cut to sign Brema. They were, you know, he was the only guy that didn't get in there. They played like an 8-man rotation at home trying to beat the Thunder. And I understand that they're still trying to compete, but I just was surprised with, you know, how many injuries we had that he couldn't even get into the game, you know, with a shortened rotation with all those injuries. And I understand we're guard heavy and that kind of thing, but I was a little bit surprised seeing that he is 6'6". He might've been one of the taller guys on the court that night. Mark, is there anything, like, I know we saw that Brogdon video. I didn't take too much from it, but do you think there is something that might be tied in there with like his work ethic a little bit? I don't know.
I have no idea. I mean, we're not there. I would say though, like, from what I know, he's a really, really hard work ethic guy, and
that's what I mean,
and a really good kid, just from everything I know. And regardless, you know, it's like he's 21 years old. I when I was 21, I think that there's this idea that like everybody is supposed to be this like quote unquote super hard worker. And I think it's not that people don't work hard, they just don't really know how to work at like a certain level. Like NBA level is different than working at Duke, you know, and I think maybe he's going through that. Like, I, again, that's just speculation. I don't know. You have to learn through trial and error sometimes, but I don't really think there's anything there that is super problematic or anything. I think that was just kind of more the guys having fun than anything else.
Yeah, and that's what I thought. And then I forget who said something to me, but they were like, well, he missed a workout or something like that. And I was like, I really would be surprised if he got punished for not playing because of that, but especially with how lax Nate Bjorkman seems to be. But anyway, I digress. Do you guys envision him making the roster next year, or do you think he'll be on another two-way deal?
I think it's probably another two-way, just because I don't see the team consolidating enough rotation players to justify having him plainly in the NBA, especially when he didn't show at the G League level that he was like above and beyond that, like Goga did, and was brought off the two-way and back onto the regular roster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't really have anything I can add to that. I think maybe if he shows something if he's able to really show something in the next 10 games, maybe my opinion will change. But right now, yeah, I'd say he's probably just another two-way guy. And that's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
But he would really benefit from having a true, like, full year of G League development.
No, I totally agree. And the only thing I kind of feel bad for Cassius, because, I mean, they are pretty guard-heavy. Brogdon, LeVert, you know, they got Aaron still. If they bring TJ McConnell back, and then, of course, Edmund Sumner, Jeremy Lamb, I mean, he can play the guard or the forward. But still, I mean, they've got a lot of, you know, guard wing depth there. And depending on what they draft in this year's draft, that could only put him even further down the depth chart. So it's just one of those things where I feel like he's not going to get a ton of opportunities right now. So I agree with you, Mark. That full year in the G League to kind of showcase who he is could really be beneficial. And, I mean, he's got the athleticism. And from everything I heard from when he was at Duke, like you said, Mark, you know, he has that work ethic. So hopefully it pays off for him, similar to Sumner, not getting a chance the first – couple of seasons, but just continuing to work hard, and it paid off 3 or 4 years later. But let's move on to the big fella, Goga Batadze. This is a guy that Kevin Pritchard had some high praise for in his one-on-one article with Bob Kravitz, and they have high expectations for him, according to Kevin Pritchard. So I'll start with you first this time, Mark. Goga, I mean, do you love him enough to think that you can trade one of the centers and be fine with him as your backup?
Yeah, definitely. Especially because I think he's already shown enough developing like that. I mean, I've felt really bad for him just getting injured in general. I mean, of course, you never want anybody to get injured, but he was really starting to play well and learning. Just the biggest thing was he was getting opportunities to learn through his mistakes and continue to play more. And, you know, I think he's taken maybe more meaningful strides on the roster than anybody, even like Ed. Like Ed's taken a lot of strides, but Goga went from like a guy who you did not want to put in the game last year to like he was very much so break glass in case of emergency. And even then, you know, there was like bulletproof glass, so you're working to break that thing. But Goga's been like, I think he's been a guaranteed rotation player this year, especially with the shot coming along too. He's really figured out some things defensively. I would definitely say he gives you enough reason. And I mean, you don't even need Goga as a reason for moving on from one of the bigs, if we're being completely honest. But
fair.
Yeah, no, I have like a lot of confidence in him. And I think it's only better for him if they do move on from them, because A, it gives him more of a meaningful route to getting playing time. And B, it's just like, he just brings a lot of things that are positive. Like he's the best shooter of the three. Like, I think Miles is a better shooter than Domas for sure. I just don't really buy Domas as a shooter right now. And clearly defenses don't either. And I mean, Goga is a shooter is already just like the form is better. The comfortability is getting there. And I think he really does have a lot as a defensive player. He's definitely not going to be better than Miles. Because there are just very few guys who are ever going to be a better defensive player than Miles Turner. But yeah, Goga brings a lot that is good. We're waiting a lot for the passing though. Like we have not seen a ton in terms of passing and operating in DHOs. And I'd really like to see that happen more. And that's another aspect of him getting more minutes. So really long-winded answer of saying, yes, I think there's definitely enough there to know that it's worth moving on from one of the bigs.
Yeah, and I wanted you to elaborate a little bit on why and kind of get into what you've seen from this year. So, Red, I'd like to hear some thoughts from you about Goga Bitadze.
Yeah, I was Mark's point about not really needing more reason to move on from one of the bigs was going to be my first point, because you really don't. Like, we have enough to know that we should move on from the Trebonis pairing, but it does help knowing that you have a really solid backup big in Goga with the ceiling for more. I don't know if he will be a starter level player at some point, if he's going to be a high level backup or what, but I mean, he just looks good on the court. He's real bouncy. Like, I think Mark was right in that he's the best shooter of the three, even though the numbers may not agree with that. I just like just watching the shot. You're like, okay, it's just like what we said earlier. You know, anytime Goga takes a shot from three, it's like, oh, that's in. And then it's definitely not. But I really think that he can develop into something really great. And I think that that's going to be one of the good things to come from moving one of the bigs, is seeing Goga develop. I mean, they took him in the first round when they already had two bigs. So like the talent is there, and they invested in him with that pick. So being able to continue to develop that is something that I'm looking forward to. I hope that he can step up to that and at least just stay healthy. Like Mark said, it's a real bummer when you see somebody who was really unplayable last year come start putting things together, but just get torn down from injury a couple times this year. So hopefully he can get healthy and then turn into a high level backup as soon as next year.
Yeah, and I know it's only been a few games here or a few seasons here, Brett, you know, 2 years for Goga Bitadze, but he's had quite a few injuries that have held him out of action. So are you at all concerned about his injury being a factor going forward?
I don't think so. I don't think they're compounding or lingering of one type of injury. I think for the most part, it's just kind of been, I don't know if fluky is the right answer, but it's just like comes with the territory of being, I feel like he's a pretty high energy player and is pretty physical. So that, I think both of those things just kind of come together and just injuries happen. But no, I don't think there's any injury concern with him at the moment.
Mark?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And it's hard to know with that stuff too, because we're not, you know, we don't have his physicals. We're not the doctors, but I would agree with you, right? I'm not really too worried about that.
So I will say that I probably already said this to you guys before, but if you're listening to this for the first time and you haven't heard me say it, when he was drafted, I actually messaged somebody and said, I think that he could be the best center on the team in like 5 to 7 years. And I don't know why I thought that, but I just seeing some of the highlights, hearing them talk about him, I might have just been in the moment at the time. but he does a lot of good things. And I believe that the front office does have high expectations for him. I do believe they think he is a really solid player. And, you know, I've heard the debate, you know, which center should you get rid of? And a lot of people say, well, you should get rid of Domas because, you know, Miles and Goga are kind of the similar player, so they fit the scheme better. But then I've also heard the counter of, well, you know, if you trade Miles and then you have somebody a little bit different in Domas, it does something totally different. So where do you guys kind of stand on that? Should it really matter which center they trade based on, you know, how the team should look? And as far as, you know, being similar in centers or being opposite in centers, or do you think they should basically just trade whoever they think they can get the most value out of? I'll start with you, Mark.
Lots to unpack there. Number one, I mean, I think I would say I don't expect Goga to be better than either Domas or Miles. I mean, both guys have been top 70, top 60 players this year. Like Miles, if he wasn't injured, he would probably be second team all defense and finish second or third in defensive player of the year. And he's been at least average on offense, which for him is a huge win considering where he has been. And Domas was an all-star and rightfully so this year. I'm going to argue both guys have been top 50 players because that's a top 50 player. I don't know if Goga's going to get to that, and it's hard to know. Like, that's why you want to move on, because maybe you can, you know, it's like the Family Guy thing. Well, look at this. You could get a boat, or you could have the mystery box, and Goga's the mystery box. Like, well, maybe he will be a boat. Who knows? And I don't mean that to sound reductive, just saying it's weird with draft prospects and trying to understand that. But, I would not put expectations that he's going to be better. I just think the biggest thing is you open up the opportunity cost of moving on from $18 million and, you know, 32 minutes played by somebody who is a starter, but they're in a spot that would make more sense to have a winger forward player there. And I don't anticipate Goga getting to being at a starting level, at least not yet. I think he will be eventually, but I'm talking my way in circles of just saying, you know, I think it's more about the opportunity cost and opening things up for Goga. In terms of who you trade, it's really just value. Like, I think you can make an argument for both guys. I also think that some of the arguments for both guys are way overplayed. Yes, of course the defense is worse without Miles. Miles is, like I just mentioned, a defensive player of the year candidate, and rightfully so. But also the way that they play the defense, there literally is nobody who can replicate on the roster what he does. And again, that's more to him, but it's also like a slight to, okay, well then if you know you can't replicate what Miles is doing, why are you still playing like this when you don't have him? Is a great point to bring up. And part of that's been personnel, but part of it's been, well, we'll funnel everything to the rim. And if there's nobody who can contest anything at the rim, that's
it's why O'Shea defense. Is almost averaging
that's
two blocks.
That's why O'Shea
a game.
Brissett's been yes. fantastic. Yeah.
That's why.
And then you could say the same thing about Domas. Like, I think whenever people talk about his defense being so bad, I'm like, well, not really. Like, it doesn't look good, but a lot of the times it's because people behind him are making mistakes. So it looks like it's on him, and it really isn't most of the time. He is definitely not in an ideal context. It could be a lot better for him, and I wish it was, because we saw last year, I mean, he was like a C-minus to a C-level defender. And it's not like an effort or anything. It's just physically he's not built to be an awesome defender. But when you put him in like this, I mean, he looks – the impact metrics have him as terrible, and a lot of that's just because the Pacers' defense is terrible, and he's out there all the time. Of course, that impacts everything. But then you look at it offensively. Well, if you trade Domas, what is this team doing offensively is my question, because I'm sure somebody will automatically be like, oh, well, you need a point guard. Okay, well, then how are you getting – like, cool, I get wanting to get a point guard, but are you trading Domas for a guy who's going to generate separation by himself without good screening and get to the rim? Because you need that. I mean, without Domas, we see it time and time again. They're like the offense cannot get separation. Like, they've been very fortunate. They have played well to their credit in this recent stretch where their offense was fantastic, but a lot of it is coming in transition and just from running fast and playing with pace. When they actually boil down and have to play in the half court, it's the offense is not as efficient. And you see how much the team misses Domas. Like, he's not I don't think he's a ball stopper. The Domas clogs the lane thing is just a lazy argument, in my opinion, because yes, he's in the lane, but That's where he operates from. And I think it's just very reductive to view it like that. But that's, again, a really long-winded response. But I just think there's merits to both guys being traded and merits to keeping either one. And it's not about liking or disliking one. It's just about who can you get the most value for, or what makes the most sense for the team moving forward. What gives you the most concrete vision of doing something better than what they're doing right now?
Goga's skill set should have absolutely no bearing on which big they trade. There should be no like, oh, well, we want to play a similar style with our starting and backup centers, or, oh, we want to play a completely different style between our starter and our bench player. It should be just like Mark said, it should be value-based and getting the best fit with the pieces that will remain on the roster, both through free agency, draft, and then post-trade, and then go from there. There's no, and we'll have no idea what those options are unless the Celtics are involved again and they leak something stupid.
Yeah, no, there's that. That's for sure. And I think you brought up a lot of great points, Mark, that I really don't need to get back into because everything you said was spot on. So let's move on to our last young guy here that I want to talk about. And that is Aaron Holiday, a guy that has had such a up and down career with the Indiana Pacers. At one point in his rookie season, the Pacers would not include him in a trade for Mike Conley Jr. because they valued him that much. And now his value, I think you said it earlier, Mark, is probably a second round pick. It might've been you, Red. I can't remember, but regardless, this is just a guy that's one of those players that
we're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.
That's been up and down his whole entire career, not very consistent, but I'm curious what his future looks like, and I'll start with you first this time, Rhett.
It's tough. I mean, it doesn't seem like he's that much of a priority for the franchise right now, or at least not to Bjorkgren with the way he's run his rotations recently. I think there was a game not that long ago where Keelan Martin and Cassius Stanley both came off the bench ahead of Aaron. And that might've been sending a message. That might've just been how strongly Bjorkgren feels about any of those guys. But I think his value is absolutely as low as it could be, but games like last night where he's able to do good things with the ball in his hands and run some pick and roll is how you increase his value, not necessarily to trade him, but just because you want him to be a better player on your roster because he is young. You will have his rights if you want, you'll have them regardless if you want them or not, going into his free agency post rookie deal. And that's important and that has value. It just depends on what other moves this team makes this summer, like we've been talking about. There's so much up in the air with the moves that they could make because they can choose to not bring back TJ McConnell. And then all of a sudden, either Sumner is your backup point guard or you have to do something else and address your backup point guard need. And then at that point, then Aaron Holiday would have a much bigger role. But then if you bring McConnell back, he's in a similar situation. Is that the best use of a player like Aaron? We don't really know. So all of that to say, his value is very low. I hope he gets good opportunity for the rest of the season to do things with the ball in his hands and get some of that confidence back and play as well as we know he can play, because it's been really hard to watch him this year and kind of frustrating to see him struggle so much when he had such a great bubble.
Mark?
Yeah. I mean, I echo everything that Rhett said. It was really cathartic last night seeing Aaron Holiday probably – I mean, that was the best he's looked as a playmaker ever with the Pacers. And but again, it's tough because they were basically playing the Oklahoma City Blue yesterday. So I don't – I'm not entirely sure what to take from it. But at the same time, he just looked comfortable and he wasn't forcing anything. And that's been the problem with him. I'm not really sure what else I can add. I just think it's gotten to the point now where, you know, they probably are going to be willing to move on from Aaron or looking to if an opportunity comes along, because I just don't know if he has, especially the way that they have started to do everything. Like, I just don't know if he has a place moving forward, because I think he is one of the guys who has looked worse with Nate's scheme or hasn't fit in as well with Nate's scheme, because he's not somebody who's great at getting to the rim and making things happen there. Like, he can be a good driver with the ball in his hands, but he's just not enough of a finisher to really be doing it. And it hasn't helped that he's been super inconsistent, but I don't know. I think that's where I lean with him.
Yeah, and I want to ask this because he did, it felt like he fell a little bit in the NBA draft. And I remember, I think it was Jay Billis had him as like his best available at like 15. And Billis was really high on him coming into the draft. And then he fell all the way to the Pacers at 23. I want to go back to you, Mark. Do you think a lot of the reason that he might be struggling with his position is just because of his height?
I mean, yeah, it doesn't help. Being 6 foot in the NBA is not easy. Mm-hmm. I don't really think it's just height though. Like, I mean, I'm sure it would help. But I do think a lot of it is just not having that consistency and really struggling with predetermined reads. Like, I mean, he telegraphs a lot of the stuff that he passes when he does pass. And I don't mean that as a slight, just like it just feels sometimes like he doesn't know if he should score or pass. Like, at the game, he's thinking like a half second slow, is the way to put it. And that's not me calling him stupid or anything. He's a very smart individual. But just in terms of his actual on-court feel, like the way that he processes the game, he's not there offensively with the rest of the team at times, it feels like, because he just you can see him constantly trying to make decisions instead of just making them. Like, in some regards, it would be better if you would just do something 100% than to have that extra delay that makes it easier for things to happen. So I think it's a lot less about the height and more just he hasn't been able to find himself offensively.
Yeah,
couldn't agree more. I think we've seen in the league there are plenty of players that are successful despite their height, and Aaron actually has like a 6'7" wingspan, so it's not like he's short and small. Like, we've seen him do well, and we've seen other players with a similar lack of height do well, but it's just the inconsistency both in his role on the court and then how he does within that role. And I think Mark's point about him, I feel like he's just overthinking so much when he's on the court, and he's just not playing free with the confidence that Ed's playing with this year, which is probably why he got jumped in the rotation. But I don't think his size has that much to do with it.
Yeah. It's there's other things obviously there. I just wonder, like, if he's a little bit bigger, could he be a little bit more impactful? I'm sure that's the case for a lot of smaller guys. So just something I threw out there because, you know, it seems the Pacers do value bigger guards, except McConnell obviously is the anomaly to that, who's been just phenomenal being an undersized player, but his basketball IQ is just through the roof. So as I kind of wrap up these young guys, I wanted to get your guys' opinions. Basically, I want you to rank 1 through 5, 1 being the most important, but who do you think fits into the future the most here with the Pacers, with these 5 guys, and kind of rank them and why you rank them that way, if that makes sense? I'll start with you, Rhett.
Goga, 1, because he's going to have a bigger role next year as they move away from the bigs. And I think he has the most untapped ceiling. I think O'Shea probably too, just because of positional versatility. I think it's very possible he just comes back to earth with the shooting, and then he's no longer as much of a priority, which is pretty well, I guess, what's the word? His deal reflects that with it being non-guaranteed.
Yeah.
Ed would for sure be three, possibly two, depending on how O'Shea does, just especially with the improvements that Sumner has shown this year. And if his shooting is real, I think he could easily jump up into that two spot right behind Goga. Aaron four, and then Cassius five, just because he's so unknown. But obviously, I think Mark was pretty on point saying that they could pretty easily move on from Aaron this summer just to get something from him, clear up the rotation a little bit more. And obviously that would put Cassius above Aaron, but yeah, not, I think one through five, that's pretty easy.
Is that the same for you, Mark?
Yeah, I don't have a difference there. I do think I would maybe put Ed over O'Shea right now, just because I still think it's kind of volatile with how the numbers are shaking out. I'm not trying to be dismissive of what he's done so far, but I just think like maybe there is a chance that Ed has a little bit more ball handling juice and the playmaking comes. I don't know. It's like a toss up. It's hard. I don't love ranking things personally, but like, it's, I think
sorry.
You put me in a tough spot. Tough spots are a good thing. It makes me grow as a writer and individual, but no, I think I would mostly agree with how Rhett had it.
Yeah, I agree with what Rhett said about O'Shea's position versus Ed's position. I think Ed's position is easier to fill, and especially for the Pacers because it's been such a hard position to fill. But I get the point, too. We've seen a larger sample size of Edmund, and it's been, you know, I think he's sustained that pretty well throughout the season, where O'Shea is a little bit smaller and the competition's been a little bit different. So, yeah, it's still small sample size for O'Shea, but I am extremely high on him. So I would probably go with the red, having O'Shea two, and then following that same ranking. But we did have a few Twitter questions, not a ton. Obviously, it's Sunday and the Pacers have not been playing well, so I completely understand why there's not as much, you know, buzz on Twitter. But got a few questions, and one of them here comes from at Hugh Pacers. This is my man Aaron, who lives in Houston. He said, with the emergence of O'Shea, does this make Miles more expendable in the offseason? I'm curious to see his fit with Domas for the rest of the season. Mark, didn't you kind of already answer this earlier?
Yes, I believe so.
So, I mean, don't want to have to go through and rehash that, but I think that it really doesn't matter. I think they should move on from one of them, like Mark said, regardless of who's on the team. But, yeah, I mean, I guess I am kind of interested to see what O'Shea looks like next to Domas. I don't know if you guys care that much about that, but I think that's interesting.
That'll say a whole lot more about O'Shea than it will either big, I think.
Yeah, that's true. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. Here's another one. We got Billy Osborne. He said, who are we keeping as our foundation builders for the next year? This feels like an end of an era in Pacers ball, and now we look to build off of new foundational players. I'll go with Brogdon and LeVert and one of the bigs, only because I can't see wanting to part ways with two 24-year-olds. Then he goes on to say, I think LeVert and Brogdon are great starting the two and the three positions. So, Red, lot to unpack there, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense that Brogdon, LeVert, and one of the bigs are the foundational pieces because they're under contract for the most, which generally lends like that tends to be the people that are you're building around. I do think that Goga can be considered a foundational piece, and he should be treated as such because of the high praise that Kevin Pritchard has for him. But obviously, as far as a starting lineup goes, I don't have any disagreements with Brogdon, LeVert, and one of the bigs.
Mark, anything to add to that?
I mean, I think that's a good question. I have been a little bit frustrated is the wrong way to put it, but like I do think it has a little bit too doom and gloom on Pacers Twitter and general discourse. Like this team is not great right now, but I don't think they're nearly as bad as people are putting it out to be. You know, obviously TJ Warren affects everything, but I still think this team is not that great, even if TJ is healthy, because they have very clear issues. Like I do think they're a lot better. They're probably like maybe the sixth seed or something, but I just think this team is like, they're willing to make big moves and shake things up. They did that earlier this year. I don't think that, I mean, they've talked about how much they want to see this group play together. And this is not me saying that I advocate for that. I think we've seen enough to know that we don't need to see this group moving forward with at least with two bigs. So I think that's how they're going to lean to, you know, I think that the foundational pieces are like Malcolm, Karis, TJ, and, you know, one of Domas and Miles. And then you go from there. I mean, I think if you're not in the starting lineup or a first round pick, you're probably expendable in some regards. And that's a very harsh way of putting it, but I just mean in terms of like being viewed as part of a 3 or 4 year window. I don't think that they would view somebody who is an eighth man on the bench as somebody who's part of a 3 or 4 year window. And maybe that's me being short-sighted, but that's just how I look at it.
I don't think that's harsh at all. I think that's realistic. Like, are you building around Doug McDermott and Justin Holiday? No, probably not. Like, they're great pieces to have on the roster and they're great people, but they're not foundational pieces. If there was a chance to upgrade those two spots, the team would probably take it because that's just the nature of them being the sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth man on the team.
Yeah. That's interesting. And I mean, I would not be upset if they did make a bigger move and trade, you know, if they go out there and make a big move, if it made sense for the team. I mean, I'm not just doing it for anybody. I've said it before on the pod, so I don't want to keep repeating myself. But if a young star becomes available or a young star wants out of a certain situation and you can offer one of your bigs plus one of your guards like LeVert or Brogdon, and that would entice the other team to get that young star here, then I think that that's something I would clearly look at. But at the same time, it's probably not realistic. So, I mean, I'm fine with the core that they have here, but I do think they need some help. I would say this, a lot of people have thrown around a lot of takes on the centers this year because it's been so topical. And one of the ones that I have been very annoyed with is how selfish Domas is. And I really don't buy into that.
I can't stand that.
To me, it's not even close to true. He sacrifices so many shots that he could take if he was a selfish player. And he leads the team in assists more than likely every game. So to me, it's like, no, the offense runs through him. That doesn't mean he's selfish. And, you know, there was one possession, I think it was against the Hawks, when it's like, I think Brogdon threw him the ball about 18 feet out. I forget who was, I don't know if it was Capella or Collins on him, but everybody just kind of like let Domas isolate. And it was a really weird possession. I don't understand why they did that. But it was one of those things where I was kind of surprised that everybody was blaming Domas for taking that shot, number one, and for trying to be a ball hog. I was like, do you really think this is what he wanted? I mean, is this what Bjorkman called? Because quite frankly, if that's what he called, an ISO 18 feet away out for Sabonis against the Hawks with either Collins or Capella on him, then that says more about Bjorkman than anything else. But, you know, there was no off-ball movement. Everybody just watched him go to work, and it didn't work out for the Pacers in that situation. So, I mean, that's where I'm at with everything. I think they need to get another – I think Karis can be a go-to scorer. There's no doubt about it. But I think they just need some more help, and getting Warren back will be a huge part of that. But if they want to move forward with this modern basketball, they're going to have to deal one of the centers. And I would be in agreement with you, Mark. I think it's more than likely Turner, just because of what happened in the offseason and what Domas does for this team offensively.
Yeah, and I think I would say, too, I just wish that we could remove selfish and unselfish from the basketball lexicon, because it's just – it's freaking basketball, man. It's not like – and also, too, it's just like what are you watching that makes you think that this guy is inadvertently trying to just take over an offense? Like that – I mean, the offense runs through him. I don't think that he really – like he's had games where he forces shots up. I'm not just like sucking up to like a single player, but – It is unfair criticism, in my opinion. But again, it's this whole season, I am very ready for this whole season to be over in some regards.
I agree.
Let's get to the draft in one piece before Pacers Twitter just erupts like Mount Vesuvius. So,
no, I agree. And I mean, if there's anything you want to call anybody selfish, I think, you know, James Harden kind of forcing his way out of Houston, that to me is selfish.
I don't think it was selfish. I think that organization.
They did it to themselves a little bit, but at the same time, like him,
like I don't agree with how James did things.
Right.
Personally, right. Like I wouldn't have handled it. I mean, it's easy for me to say I wouldn't have handled it that way. But I also think like we do have to look at it and say, you know, this organization is totally at fault. You know, Tillman Fertitta is probably the worst owner in basketball.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Like we don't put enough blast on organizations and front offices. And a lot of times we put it on the players and coaches. And I just like, I don't like how James handled that. And it was icky, which I can't believe I just said icky on a podcast, but like, I can't believe it. Like, I don't like how he had things play out personally, but I would understand his grievances. Like I do understand his grievances. I just, I don't personally agree with, you know, like some of the things he did off court, but like, it's not like he's a bad guy or anything, but I don't necessarily agree with selfish. Like, I think at some point it's like, you know, you're like the whole team aspect just gets so overplayed to me. Like, it's professional sports. This isn't high school. Like, you can be a team when you're winning and together and everything, but when it's not, it's very different. So
I agree.
I don't know. That's just where I'm coming from.
Well, they're all competing for jobs too. You know, that's the big
thing.
Exactly. So we got to put that into perspective, because some of these guys, you know, Harden's fine, but you know, some of the guys that he's playing with might not make it in the league after so many years, just because of how many new people come and go with the draft and all that kind of stuff. So great point there. But last question, I'm going to set this one up for Rhett to answer first, because I know his answer. This comes from David Mateo. Does Brogdon at the one slow the team down? And then question two, would you sign and trade Miles Turner for Lonzo Ball? Rhett, take it away.
I mean, I don't know what you're inferring by saying you know my answer, but no, I think that would be a decent move. Like, I don't know what the other options are out there for Miles Turner. Lonzo has been playing really well, and he answers a lot of questions. I think for the team, shooting almost 40% from three on high volume, being able to push the pace in transition, guard one through three pretty well. But it depends on the number that Lonzo is going to get. Yeah. But I think that it would, to be able to turn 2 years of Miles Turner at $18 million into presumably 4 years of Lonzo Ball at around the same number, I think that would be pretty decent. But again, that's more of a guard, which we already have. Wow. It'd be interesting to see
what already picture the article that I'm writing if the team trades for Lonzo Ball, because he's not a point guard. Like, no, I really wish that, oh man, dude, I can already think right now the amount of people that he's going to play. Like, in this theoretical trade, Lonzo Ball plays two games for the Pacers.
Mm-hmm.
He gets to the rim about twice.
Yep.
And people are already calling for his head. I'm like, well,
he's a shooting guard.
You know, he's a wing, man. Like, he's really good. Like, I think his defense isn't quite as good as I think people pointed out to be. Part of that's because he's on a better really fit. Terrible defensive team. But like, in Indiana, he'd make a lot of sense, and I think he would be really good. But I also think, like, he's not the point guard that you necessarily want. Like, he's not going to get Malcolm off ball. He's not going to get Karis off ball. Like, he could be a nice off ball wing who does a lot of things defensively and like a good connective playmaker. But if you think you're trading for a point guard, you are mistaken, because I think New Orleans has found themselves mistaken in thinking that they trade. Like, I'm that's most reductive. Like,
no, that's why they have Bledsoe.
What they were getting for him. Well, it has not worked out with Bledsoe either. But,
not at all.
Yeah, but no, just point being, Lonzo would be a good fit, but he's more like a B-plus type fit than, like, if you're really going out and getting somebody who's driving the game effectively, like the way that people are envisioning. But at the same time, like, it's very difficult to get a guy who's like an A or A-plus fit, because they end up being an A or A-plus fit on almost any roster, so nobody wants to trade them.
Yeah, so that kind of answer, well, that kind of helps with my question, because what realistically would you get for Miles in a trade if you're just thinking based off value and what people think across the league? I mean, would they be in the same category value wise, or do you think that one has more value than the other? Between those two guys, Miles and Lonzo.
I think that's tough. It just depends on how teams view him. I mean, I don't have a good sense for how people view Lonzo around the league. I know that, I mean, he's always in, you know, everybody apparently wants to have him under the sun. I know, like, the Bulls have definitely been a team mentioned at trying to go after him, and they will have, I want to say that they have the opportunity to actually do that this summer. But I mean, they've got to be like close ish in terms of trade value, I would imagine. Like, I don't know. Where are you on that, Rhett?
I think it's very hard to find a one-for-one player swap in this league that makes sense, but this might actually be one of them. I don't know. I feel like both sides would feel like they would want more back, because Miles is a Defensive Player of the Year candidate, but only has 2 years left on his deal. So New Orleans would probably be like, well, we're taking 2 years less. So I feel like ultimately it would end up being a pretty much straight swap, but I don't know. I think team context depends so much for both of these guys, because like Mark said, Lonzo is not a point guard. So you have to have somebody on the team who can operate as the primary ball handler in the half court. And then Miles is a big, and just bigs are generally less valuable around the league unless the team needs one. And I mean, obviously every team could benefit from Miles's skill set, but there's limitations that come along with that. So I think that's about as even as a one for one as you're going to find. But I also don't think that that's very likely.
All right. I don't know if we answered the first part of that question, so I apologize. But the first part of that question was, does Brogdon at the one slow the team down? So Mark, I'll let you answer that question.
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on what you mean by slow the team down, like prevent the team from being better.
I'm thinking maybe more pace is what this is asking.
Given how the team's been in pace this year, I don't think it slows the team down.
No.
Yeah. Like, at least I don't think I've seen anything that indicates that. I haven't checked the numbers, but I would imagine that they back that up. So I would say no.
Okay. Rhett, would you agree?
Yeah. That, I mean, he's not the fastest player on the court. So in that regard, maybe he slows the team down by not being very fast. But I think that the pace of the team this year has been – high enough to say that Brogdon is definitely not the one holding them back in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of times you'll see Sabonis get the rebound and bring the ball up the court. It's not like he's faster than Malcolm either. You know, I mean, he's done that quite a bit of the time. But all right, so this isn't a question anybody else has. This is an Alex question. Obviously, it feels like Charlotte has been the team that's most interested in adding a center to their roster. Cody Zeller is a free agent. I'm not even going to say which center we trade, but if we were to trade one of our centers to the Hornets, are there any players that you would like to target in getting back in a trade for one of our centers? And I guess you can kind of dive into that. Red, I'll let you start it off.
I mean, you definitely have to get one of Bridges or Washington, or the Pacers don't do it.
Yeah.
And I think that asking the Hornets to give up more than Bridges and Washington would make them kind of turn their nose up at it, especially with the leaps that Bridges has made this year and the versatility that Washington offers them as somebody who can play small ball five. I would be hard pressed to trade either big for like Malik Monk and Miles Bridges. I think that's just doesn't seem quite right, but trades almost never seem quite right. So maybe I'm off.
Mark?
It's tough because Monk has had some difficult off-court issues. Luckily, it seems like he's starting to get past them. Paolo Ughetti wrote a really great article about that at The Ringer that you guys should check out. But, I mean, I do think Malik Monk brings as a versatile combo guard. I know teams chock full of combo guards, but I don't think that they would offer Malik Monk and Miles Bridges. That's a lot to get back, I think, just given what Monk was. Monk had a really good stretch before he had dealt with an injury this year. But, I mean, even just getting back either Bridges or Washington in like some kind of one-for-one, which you can't really do a one-for-one in this situation given contracts, but either of those guys would be just so good. Like, Miles Bridges is probably my most improved player this year.
Yeah.
But PJ hasn't had quite the year I was – yeah. I think okay. So. I mean, Julius Randle's improvement's been huge, and he's I just did my all NBA teams yesterday, and he's third team for me. But like, Julius went from like a pretty good player who just was in a bad context to Miles being like a legitimately bad NBA player last year to being like one of the top 100 players in the league this year. And that's just, to me, that's a bigger jump to make than Julius did. So it's close, but like, I would personally have Miles Bridges.
Okay. Yeah. I was high on Miles a little bit last year as maybe a swap. And I was, I did it with Tony. That's the podcast where your power went out last year. I don't know if you remember that, Mark, but that's when we lost the recording and had to go back and redo it all.
I do remember.
Yeah. So that was an interesting, fun time. And I think I went through the players list with Tony by myself that night because of that. And we had a Miles Bridges conversation. I thought, man, he does kind of make some sense for what they want. I was real high on PJ Washington coming into the draft. I really liked his game. He went earlier, I guess, not maybe earlier than I expected, but around the time I expected. I didn't think he'd get to 18 for the Pacers when they drafted Goga. But yeah, I mean, I think both those guys are really intriguing, and I would be fine with either of them. Like you said, though, the salary would be a bit of a problem. because they don't match up. And that's where I think it could get a little bit difficult unless you got a third team involved and did something like that, which always getting third teams can make it more difficult. But yeah, I don't really know where the Hornets would go as far as upgrading if they got Turner. I mean, I think he would be a big upgrade for him at that center position, but or Sabonis. But I think, you know, just depends on what you get back, and that's where it's tough, because I do like Bridges, but I think if you did trade Sabonis over Turner there to Charlotte, you could probably be more comfortable getting a first round pick back. Maybe this year's first round pick. I think it probably falls around 15, 16. I don't know if the Pacers would really want that, but because they're not. And then when we talked to Pritchard, he was not like super keen on draft picks being like that big of a deal to him. So bigger deal to fans than us, I think. But to them, they didn't really seem to care that much about draft picks. So at least it gives them some more, you know, assets to trade. But yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. I don't really know. I haven't gone into enough detail and depth of where I wanted these guys to go or where they could fit. That'll be an off-season topic. But I just thought I'd ask because I know Charlotte's been rumored. But anyways, that's going to wrap up our show today. So, Red, where can people find you at on Twitter? And do you have anything coming out for 8 points, 9 seconds?
You can find me at Rhett_Bauer, R-H-E-T-T underscore B-A-U-E-R. And I am still chewing on something for 8 points, 9 seconds. I haven't quite decided where I want to go with it yet, but yeah.
Okay, awesome. Mark, where can the people find you at? And you have any new articles coming out or any new podcasts that you'd like to highlight?
Yeah, you can find me at MSchindlerNBA on Twitter. I have an article on Darius Baisley coming out either tomorrow or the next day. My draft coverage is starting up at Indy Cornrows this week. You can find me doing a lot of stuff, a lot of different places. I think would be the best way to put it. But thanks for having me on, man.
Absolutely. Great conversation. Make sure you follow our podcast page at Setting the Pace 3. I'm at Alex Golden NBA, and myself and Fachi will be back later this week to continue talking about the Pacers. Hope you guys have a great rest of your day.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.